So Lama Tsongkhapa wrote the three principal aspects of the path with great compassion to show us what we need to practice and actualize in our life. And it's a pretty powerful prayer. I thought what I'd do, like I said, is focus on the last of the three principal aspects of the path, but today give you an overview of the first and perhaps the second so that you have some background for what we're doing. So it starts out saying, I bow down to the venerable spiritual masters. So here he's paying homage to the whole lineage of teachers from Shakyamuni Buddha down to his own teachers. And so this is common practice in Buddhism, to hold our teachers with utmost respect, because we realize that all chance we have to practice comes from the kindness of our teachers, from Shakyamuni Buddha through the whole lineage down to our own teachers. So that's why it begins with homage to the spiritual masters. And then he states his wish to compose the text and why he's doing it. So he says, as well as I will explain as well as I am able, the essence of the teaching of the conqueror, so the teachings of the Buddha. So the path praised by the conquerors and their spiritual children, that is by the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. And it's the entrance for the fortunate ones who desire liberation. So these are the principal practice, the entrance to the path for the people who desire liberation. So if you desire simply the happiness of this life, this is not the practice that you want to do. Okay? If you desire something more than the happiness of this life, if you desire actual liberation from cyclic existence and enlightenment, then this is your practice. So this is the difference between what I call Dharma light and Dharma. Okay? Because there is this new phenomena called Dharma light. And it is... And it's exactly that. It's it's Dharma that is Dharma, but it's taught for people who are not yet ready to think about liberation and enlightenment. People who really are seeking basically to just make their life a little bit happier here and now, get rid of some of their gross problems gross problems, you know, relationship problems, things like this. But the people aren't quite ready yet to think beyond the happiness of this life. Whereas this text is really written for people who are ready to think beyond the happiness of this life. Yeah. And so that's actually... the demarcation between actual Dharma practice, what is Dharma and what isn't Dharma, is when we're still involved with attachment to the happiness of this life, then the practice that we do with that kind of motivation is not actual Dharma practice. Okay? It still might benefit our mind and help us, get rid of some layers of attachment and anger and so forth, but because we're not really thinking beyond my happiness now, it doesn't become actual Dharma practice. So actual Dharma practice begins when we're when we're able to think beyond my happiness now. That's a rather startling demarcation line for many of us, especially those of us who have never even considered the possibility of future lives. Okay, so it necessitates actually quite a big change in our mentality to actually begin Dharma practice. Okay, so even to talk about future lives You know, that takes some time for many of us to come to have some idea about. And, you know, there's some conversation about this in the Western Buddhist community, about the necessity of having some belief in future lives. And I fall on the side of thinking that it's quite important. Why? Because if we don't believe in the existence of future lives, then when we suffer, it seems like the best way to stop suffering would simply be to die. Because if there's nothing after death and you're miserable, that seems the way to do it. However, if you think that there might be something after death, then you begin to think that what you do now influences what you experience. And so then you have some more attentiveness and care as to what you do now, because, you know, it creates the cause for what you experience in the future. Okay? So then, you know, so then belief in karma comes in. Then also there's the depth of compassion becomes much greater, because if our compassion if we don't believe in rebirth, then our compassion is only for people suffering in this life. So then what we see as suffering is basically what we call the ouch kind of suffering. You know, what is very gross suffering that even animals can recognize. You know, physical suffering, mental unhappiness. Our compassion becomes for that level of suffering. On the other hand, when we have some faith in the existence of rebirth, our compassion becomes much, much, much deeper, because we see that suffering isn't just the gross physical and mental suffering that even animals recognize, but there's also two further levels of suffering. One that we call changeable suffering, which is actually what we call happiness in our ordinary life. And then the third kind of suffering, which is called pervasive compounded suffering. And that's the suffering, or rather than call it suffering, the dukkha, the unsatisfactory condition of having a body and mind under the influence of afflictions, ignorance, anger, and attachment, and karma. And that level of suffering, you know, if we don't believe in rebirth, we don't see it as suffering. Okay, we don't see it as unsatisfactory. Because we're just taking, you know, what appears to our senses as all there is. But when we realize that, you know, our life had a cause before it, in other words, afflictions and karma, and our present life has a result after it due to our present afflictions and karma, then the notion of dukkha, unsatisfactory conditions, becomes much broader. Okay, it's not just breaking our leg or, you know, being unhappy. It's being in the whole situation of having a body and mind that are under the influence, under the control of afflictions and karma. Okay, so that kind of compassion is much, much, much deeper. And then we really seek a method to get out of the situation, to get out of cyclic existence. And that's why we seek the wisdom that understands emptiness, because it's the antidote to the afflictions and karma that keep us within cyclic existence. But, you know, if we don't believe in cyclic existence, because we don't believe in rebirth, then seeking the wisdom that gets us out of it, why exert the effort? Okay? So this is why I think that having some feeling for rebirth is quite important. Like I said, it takes some time to generate that. It's a real big shift in our worldview, but it has quite a profound effect on our life when we do that. So it takes just, you know, some contemplation, some thinking about it. Because when we begin to think about rebirth, like I said, we begin to see that what we see with our eyes isn't all that there is. And what we think of as me isn't all that is going on. Okay? Because we have very strong grasping at me. And we can see that right now our grasping at me centers basically upon our adult me, who we think we are at this very moment. When we consider that we were children, there was an I at that point. I, big I, you know. There was an I at that moment, but it was different than the I that we have now, because our body and mind were different. Okay? If we live to be 80 years old, the I that we have then will be a continuation of the I that we have now, but it's also different because our body and mind, the basis upon which we label I, is different. Okay? If we begin to think of previous lives and that there was a body and mind then, okay, that preceded this body and mind, we can label I independence upon that body and mind. If we think of the continuity of our mind after death in this life and it taking another body, then we can label I independence upon our future bodies and minds. So then when we say, I want happiness, it has a much bigger meaning. It's not just the me that exists on this present day in 2005. It's the larger, the more general I, the more general me, you know, that is going to continue on to the future. Okay, so the shift in worldview is quite important, I think, because it also makes us see our actions and our experiences in relationship to who we were before and who we will be later. Some of you have been reading the Sangata Sutra, and I think that that's one of the main things, the main point that comes across in that sutra, is beginning to see what we experience now as a result of our previous actions. Yeah? And therefore realizing that when we have unhappiness, it indicates that we need to do some purification of previous life's actions or even this life actions that we did earlier. And we begin to see our I is situated also in relationship to who we're going to be in the future. So therefore what's going on now isn't just what, you know, I feel, what I experience now, but more importantly, as I was saying before, how we respond to what we experience now. And so therefore the causes that we're creating now for the person or people, the continuation of what we're going to be in the future. Okay? So then when we have that perspective, we start to look at our actions from that perspective. And, you know, in the discussion group it came up that we were often doing something and at the same time saying, why in the world am I doing this? You know, and how hard that is to stop. When we begin to think about the karmic results of our actions, it becomes much easier to stop the negative actions because we see that the result isn't just maybe creating some trouble or relationship problem in this life, But we begin to see that the result of acting with a harmful motivation extends far beyond this life into future lives and has a long-term result. We begin to actually have some concern for who we're going to be in the future lives and what kind of result our present action is going to have for those future lives. Okay? So, for example, if you're feeling cold right now, this is a hint. but actually, seeing it as, this is some suffering result, some unpleasant result coming from the previous life's karma. Okay? So, experiencing an unpleasant result because of negative actions that we created in the future. And then how do we respond to it now? Do we respond with anger, with aversion? Do we accept it, and think, okay, this is the result of my karma, now that karma is finishing? Because however we react to the experience of being cold now creates the cause for yet again experiences in future lives. Okay? So it helps us restrain from getting angry or restrain from complaining. It doesn't mean that you have to sit here and shiver the whole time. Okay? We can request that they turn up the heat. But, it helps us restrain from having negative attitudes. Okay, so you're seeing the sense of what I'm talking about? Okay. Listen with clear minds, you fortunate ones, who direct your minds to the path pleasing to the Buddha. Okay, why does the path please to the Buddha? Because it leads to total freedom of suffering. And strive to make good use of freedom and fortune without being attached to the joys of cyclic existence. So here, Lama Tsongkhapa J. Rinpoche is encouraging us to make use of the freedom and fortune of our present life without being attached to the joys of cyclic existence. Okay? So he's asking us to look beyond my happiness now, and even to look beyond my happiness in future lives. So he's stretching us even a bit further. Yeah. So caring for our happiness in future lives, that is a Dharma motivation, because it is at least pulling us out of my happiness now. But he's stretching us a little bit further and saying, well, it's good to have happiness in future lives, but what about getting out of the merry-go-round altogether? Okay. And so now he's going to show us how to generate the determination to be free, or what is also called renunciation. And renunciation is vastly misunderstood. In the West, we hear the term renunciation and we renounce it. Renunciation, that's very unpleasant. I don't want that. Okay? We don't understand that what renunciation is about is renouncing dukkha, renouncing the unsatisfactory conditions of cyclic existence. Instead, we think renunciation is of pleasure. Okay? It's not of pleasure. There's nothing wrong with experiencing pleasure. What causes dukkha is attachment to the pleasure, is anger when we don't get the pleasure. Okay? Pleasure comes, it's fine. Pleasure goes, that's okay. When we get attached to pleasure coming, when we get angry and upset because pleasure goes, that's when we get involved in creating the causes of suffering. Okay. So what we're renouncing is the ignorance, anger, and attachment, and the dukkha, the suffering that they cause. Okay. Okay, and remember, dukkha doesn't just mean the odd kind of suffering. It also means what we call changeable dukkha, which is what we call happiness. Okay, you have a good meal. Now, why is that called dukkha? Well, because it brings some pleasure and then the pleasure ends. And because the action of eating in itself isn't inherently pleasurable. Because if it were, then the more we ate, the happier we would be. What happens when we overeat? Misery. Okay. If we look at anything that we call happiness in this life, if we think of doing it continuously without stop, do we think of our happiness increasing or not? Okay. So think of something that causes you happiness. Listening to some music you like. If you kept listening to that same piece of music over and over and over again, would it create more and more happiness? Mm-hmm. No. Okay. If you think of being with the person that you just love to bits and you were with them 25 hours a day, would your happiness increase and increase? No. Okay? If we think of anything that we derive pleasure and happiness from, you know, in samsara, we realize that it's the action or the experience itself isn't really the nature of joy, because the more we do it, it's not that we get happier. At a certain point, it becomes misery. So what we call happiness is actually suffering starting small. And when it gets to a certain point, then we start calling it suffering. It changes from happiness to suffering. Like in the example of eating. When you're hungry, it is certain. When you start to eat, it's happiness. At a certain point, the eating becomes misery. Or lying on the beach, you know, it starts out happiness. At a certain point, it becomes misery. Anything we can think of within cyclic existence at a certain point becomes unsatisfactory. Okay? So this is why that second kind of suffering, or dukkha, is called the dukkha of change. Yeah? Because it changes from happiness into overt misery at some point. And this is also one of the reasons why we want to get out of cyclic existence altogether. Because we see that as long as we're stuck in it, the best we can hope for is that, you know, something that gives happiness now and later turns into suffering. Okay? If we want actual happiness, the undeclining happiness that's not going to go away, you know, then we aspire for liberation, for cyclic existence. Okay. This is quite important. And it's quite important to be aware of this so that we know why we're meditating too. Because our motivation for meditation creates the results of our meditation. If we're meditating just for the happiness of this life, that's fine, but the best results we'll get is the happiness of this life. If we're meditating for the happiness of future lives, we'll get that result. Okay, if we meditate for liberation, we'll get that result. If we meditate for the purpose of enlightenment, for the benefit of beings, our meditation will bring that result. Of course, it takes longer. Okay? And if we're very attached to getting immediate results, then having a long-term motivation is difficult. Okay? Which is why we often fall back into the attachment for the happiness of this life. My pleasure now. Okay. For you embodied beings bound by the craving for existence, That phrase always gets me. You know, to think of yourself as an embodied being bound by the craving for existence. Does that describe you? Mm-hmm. It does, doesn't it? Embodied being craving for existence. I mean, what we fear is death so much, don't we? Because death seems to us to be non-existent. Non-existence. Yeah. But embodied beings bound by the craving for existence. When I was in Thailand, they have a practice there where the monastics go to watch autopsies. Okay? Yeah, some of you are waking up now. The reason they do it is because when you actually look at what this body is, then it brings a very deep understanding of what it is we're attached to. Okay? And what we're craving to have and what we fear losing. So the authorities in Thailand are very good about this because it's a Buddhist country, so they let the monastics come and watch the autopsies. I don't know in our country. You probably have to sign 50 million release forms. But so I asked the master of the monastery where I was staying if it would be possible. So he phoned the hospital, and when they had an autopsy to do, then they rang us back and we went there. So it was a very interesting experience. And we went there, and initially, I mean, they were very kind. They sat us down and gave us tea and everything. And one of the monks was so sweet, because I went with my one woman accompanied me on this trip, one of my friends from Singapore. And then some of the monks were on the trip. So one of the monks was terribly concerned that she and I might faint. We looked at him with like, we weren't dainty, frail, weak women. Actually, one of the monks had fainted the previous time they had gone to see an autopsy. So he was a little bit concerned that we would. But we didn't. But it was very interesting. So after tea, we went in there and watched the autopsy. And do you want to hear about it?
Yeah.
It's good. It's good. So the guy had been found dead in the water. You know, the hospital was near the I think it's the Gulf of Siam. And he had been found dead. They didn't know the cause of death. He was a middle-aged man, overweight, and rigor mortis had set in, you know, and the blood had settled to the bottom parts of his body, so it was discolored. So they, you know, turned him over and, you know, looked for external signs of harm, and there weren't any. And then they started with the skull. So first of all, you walk in, you know, and he's lying there, stark naked, and you keep on thinking, like, well, you look at the tools. First of all, the tools look like kitchen knives, okay, and I think probably maybe some of them are. I mean, they really look like kitchen knives, you know, big ones and small ones and everything. And you're kind of waiting for him to, you know, say, okay, I think I'm going to get up and get dressed now. You know, and then you realize, no, that's not what's going to happen, you know, that the guy's really dead, that there's no consciousness there. So they start with the skull and they make a slice, like right across here. And then, you know how yesterday I was talking about how we put on personas? You know, so our personas are all our little masks. Well, what's really amazing after they make the slice across the scalp here is they just peel it back just like a mask. It's incredible. It's just like a mask. It just comes back right so easily, so that the top of the skull just, you know, comes all the way over here and it covers the eyes and like that. And then they peel it back that way, really, just like we're wearing a mask. And it reveals the skull. Then they have this instrument. It also looks like some kind of, you know, kitchen utensil, except I'm not sure what you use it for in the kitchen. But it has a round blade at the end that goes around, but the top part looks like what you would have on a, you know, some kind of anything with a motor. So they hold that, and this thing spins around, and then they start cutting here, you know, so to make like a skull cup, like, you know, you use in tantra practice. So they cut the skull off here. Then they take it, like something that looks like a kitchen knife, and pry it off, and the skull goes pop, and they take the skull off. And then he just reaches in with his hands, and goes pop, and the brain comes out. Just like that. Just goes pop. You know, and there's this brain sitting in your hands. Now, for scientists who think that the mind is the property of the brain, I mean, it really came clear to me when you're just looking at that brain, that that brain is just a blob of vegetable goo. It's like any other organ in the body. There's no consciousness there. And so they popped out the brain, put it down on the chopping board, you know, like a wooden board you use in the kitchen, took out one of the knives, and you know how you slice vegetables and you go, that's what they did to the brain. You know, like cut it this way and then cut it this way. My friend and I were laughing afterwards. We were ready for them to take out the frying pan. I mean, it sounds gross, but this is, you know, I mean, just, this is what happened. The autopsy was done. You know, so they were looking for signs within the brain. Didn't find anything, you know. So then just put the brain in, you know, one of the plastic bowls there. Then there's some membrane in the bottom of the skull, kind of tore that out. It sounded like a piece of paper getting torn out. You know, so then it's just completely hollow in there. Actually, before they sew the body up, they put newspaper inside. They don't put the brain back in the skull. They put newspaper. Yeah? And then put the skull on top. But anyway, they didn't fill that him back up until later. Okay. So first they did the brain. Then they started here. And so they sliced right down the middle of your sternum from here all the way down to your groin. By the way, they had all the knives and the tools right on top of his groin, because that was the area where, you know, closest to reach to. So they cut all the way down here and pull back the skin, and there's the sternum. And so then they, you know, cut the ribs on one side, cut them on the other side so they can take the sternum out. So the sternum comes out, okay, and then the rib cage is revealed. So they kind of open that up a little bit. And then, good part, really, I mean, if you look at what this body is, what we're so attached to, then they slit all the way up here, you know, to your chin, you know, so you're slit all the way from here, all the way down. And then they reach in here and start cutting the tissues around the tongue and around the esophagus and then slowly around there. And then they reach in and grab at the back of the tongue and the back of the esophagus and pull, you know, with both hands, pull it out, you know. So what comes out is the tongue, the esophagus, the lungs, and the heart all at one pull. It goes, you know, and if they have to pull really hard, it all just rips out. And there it is sitting there. You know. Yeah. And it's like, this is what's inside of our body. You know, this is it. And so his lungs were completely black. You know, I don't know if he was a smoker or the pollution, but completely black. Because he had died from drowning, they wanted to look inside of his lungs to see if there was water in there. So, you know, take a lung, put it on the chopping board, you know, with your kitchen knife, open it up, start pushing the tissue, squeezing it, you know, and some water did come out from there. They actually, at the end, determined that that the cause of death was drowning. It wasn't that he had been killed before. Oh, because at first, before they took off the skull, they looked in his eyes and they explained to us that if he had been strangled first and then thrown in the water, then his eyes would have been red, because I guess it stops the blood flow. But his eyes weren't red. And then there was the water in the lungs, okay? And then they took out the heart. The heart was in kind of a sack, and cut it away from the lungs. Put that on the chopping board. Start chopping that and looking inside of the heart. Then they looked in the stomach. They pulled out, he had eaten beforehand, so there was some food still in the stomach. Put the food in a bowl. You know, then they start pulling out the liver. His liver was really enormous. I couldn't believe how big the liver is. By the way, all these things, they have a scale there, you know, like the kind of scale that you use in the food market, you know, like a big scale with a basin, you know, so they weigh all the organs, you know, and they throw the lungs in there, weigh it, write it down, take them out, you know, throw the liver in there, weigh it, take it out. You know, kind of like the vegetable vendors do. So, you know, took out his liver, took out his kidneys. Yeah, his kidneys were dark too. Are kidneys usually dark, Peter? Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's what color his kidneys were. They took them out, took out some other internal organs. By the way, when they cut him open, you know, and revealed his intestines just kind of like bubbled out. They were kind of all pinkish and just kind of, you know, bubbled out. And because he was overweight, you could see, you know, in the skin, the layers of fat that were there. You know, so they started just looking through all the internal organs, cutting different things, looking at them. They found water in his stomach also. You know, so that's, I guess, another indication that he drowned. So, you know, looked at everything and weighed it and took samples of certain parts and put it in a jar. I think they found that there was some alcohol too in his blood, so they thought maybe he had been drinking and then, who knows, fell in the bay or whatever. It's hard to know how he got there. Okay, so they look at all of this, you know, and you're looking at it, you know, and at one point you're looking in and, you know, the whole cavity here is just empty. Yeah, and you can see front to back in it. So when they got done, then they just put all the organs back in, but not necessarily where they belong. Yeah. So they put some more newspaper up here, you know, where the tongue and the mouth are, I guess, to make it so they didn't collapse when the family saw it. So they stuffed some more newspaper in here. And then in the rest, they just took it off and just put it in. You know, the brain, the heart, anything, any which way, just stuffed it all back in. Okay, and then, you know, put the skull back on here on top of the newspaper, and then, you know, put the scalp back this way, and the scalp back this way, and then stitched it up, okay? And then here, then they started here, right under his chin, and started stitching up, you know, put the sternum and everything back, closed it back up. Stitched up all the way down. At the very end, there's a little bit of intestine sticking up. So you know how when you're packing a suitcase and it's really full, you have to stuff it in? Well, that's exactly what we did. And just stuff it in and then, you know, finish the stitching. And stitched them all up again. Yeah? And I'm sitting there, you know, looking, you know, and that's why this phrase, you know, you embody beings bound by the craving for existence is so strong, because we're embodied, and look what we're living in, you know, this thing of this sack of filth, basically. Yeah. You know, when Buddhism talks about the body being filthy, it's not in the same way as Christianity. It's not that the body's sinful and evil and stuff like that. But it's more just, well, let's look at what it is for what it is. You know, and the inside of the body is, you know, it's not very appetizing. Yeah. It's interesting. One of the incarnation of one of my teachers, who was in a monastery in South India, made the comment that because outside the temple area in the monastery, they have these kind of metal bars in the ground, you know. And I asked him why they had those, and it's so that the cows can't walk over them, you know, because the cows just roam around. But so he made the comment about how when the cows are alive, you don't want them going in the temple, but when the cows are dead, you want them cooked, and then they go and you eat them, you know. Then they go in the temple and get served. But I mean, when you eat meat, that's what you're doing. You're eating somebody's corpse. Okay. So it really, you know, kind of points out exactly what this body is. You know, the whole autopsy was very much like, I don't know if you've ever been to what they call a wet market. I don't know if they even have those in the States anymore, but in Asia they do. A wet market is where they just have the corpse of the animal, mm-hmm. and they cut it apart right there and sell you the various organs. So that's very much, you know, I mean, in America, you know, it's all sanitized and wrapped in saran wrap and looks nice. But, you know, in other countries you see the meat you eat more vividly, you know, where it comes from. So the autopsy is very much like going to a wet market. I mean, that's basically what this body is. And that is what we are so attached to. You know, this thing that if you cut it open, we all go, blah. Yeah? I mean, it's not beautiful. Somehow the skin we put on top of it masks it, and we think the skin is beautiful, so we think the body is beautiful. But, you know, it actually isn't. And if you look at what comes out of the body, you know, I mean, all the orifices of the body, it's just bliss. So, you know, and yet this is what we cherish the most. You know, it's like, I don't want to die, I don't want to leave this body, I've got to protect this body at all costs, I've got to make this body beautiful, I don't want it to age, you know, it's got to look, you know, healthy, it's got to be handsome, or it's got to be gorgeous, and, you know, all the identity we create around our body. I mean, just think of how many self-concepts, how many images we create around this body. You know, the self-concept of whatever gender we are, of whatever age we are, of whatever nationality or ethnic group we are, whatever racial group we are, whatever sexual orientation we are. You know, so many identities we create based on this body. And what is this body? You know? You just cut it open and, you know, there's a liver, there's the lungs, there's the pancreas, you know, there's the stomach. The stomach's really gushy and moot. You know, I mean, the other organs are like cohesive, you know, you pull the liver out and it's one cohesive thing, you know, and the kidneys are a cohesive thing. But the stomach is just kind of this gooey blob, you know. And it's like, this is what we treasure. You know, are we crazy or are we crazy? Yeah. When you begin to see this, you know, then you begin to realize why the Buddha said that our mind was out of touch with reality. Yeah? Because the actuality of our body and what we think of our body are like 180 degrees apart. Yeah. And then we develop so much identity, like I was saying, based on this body, And yet all the body is basically a hunk of meat. Yeah, that's going to get thrown out. When I was in Varanasi, not this trip, but previous trips, Varanasi is right along the Ganges River. So many people come to Varanasi to die, or somebody dies at home and then they bring the corpse to Varanasi to be cremated. So they have the cremations right there, you know, on the river. And, you know, they have some wood, put the body in, build some more wood, light it, you know, the body burns. And if the body doesn't burn completely, the dogs come and gnaw the meat off the bones. Yeah? Just like the bones you feed your dog, except it's our bones. Yeah. So it's really, you know, kind of wakes us up and, you know, what does it mean to be an embodied being? Yeah. Who thinks I need to have this body at all costs? Yeah. I mean, such a limited view. Because we, you know, we talk about, you know, the great beings, you know, like the Buddha, who has a body of light. You know, Buddha doesn't have this kind of body. Buddha can manifest a body that looks like this kind of body. But from the side of a Buddha, they don't have this kind of body. You know, they have a body made of light. And yet we can't even imagine having a body of light, so we get attached to this thing. And then when we die, we develop all this fear of leaving this body, because without this body, who are we going to be? You know, there's so much fear of our losing our identity when we lose the body. So if I don't have this body, who am I? Yeah. And so then grasping, craving. And it's that craving and that grasping at the time of death that makes the karma ripen, that throws us right into the next rebirth. Okay? And that's how cyclic existence continues, you know? We wind up plop, right in another rebirth, then develop another identity based on that body, trying to protect this body, you know, and trying to please this body, create more negative karma. Yeah, at the time of death of that life, then fear of losing the body, craving for another body, karma ripens, and there we go again, into the next body. And we've been doing this since beginningless time. Yeah, not just a year or two, not just a couple of lifetimes, not just a couple of eons, but beginningless time. Okay? All under the influence of ignorance. All under the influence of attachment. The second noble truth, when they say it, you know, they always bring attachment up as the example, or as the root of samsara. Actually, ignorance is the root of samsara. But in describing the Four Noble Truths, they often bring the example of attachment, because attachment is so strong, you know? Attachment all the time. I mean, it's an interesting thing just to look at during the retreat, how all the time, every moment, the mind is looking for happiness. It's so attached to happiness. How can I eke out any little bit of happiness I possibly can from any little experience I have? You know, watch it when you're sitting and eating lunch. You know, I want to eat a carrot now because I think that carrot's going to give me more happiness than the string bean. You know, I mean, look, you have several different things on your plate. Why at one moment do you eat the carrot and not the string bean? Why do you eat a few bites of this and then go to a few bites of that? What's the motivation? It's all, how can I eke out any possible bit of pleasure I can? So when we get tired of string beans, we eat carrots. And when we get tired of carrots, we eat dal. When we get tired of dal, we go back to the string beans. Okay? Just give me a little bit of pleasure. Look at how you decide what clothes you're going to wear in the morning. Yeah? Why do we have so many clothes of so many different styles? so many different colors, so many different textures. Because every morning there's the chance to eke out some bit of pleasure by wearing what we feel like wearing, by wearing something that's going to make us look good, by wearing something with the texture of material that feels pleasant. Okay? So, you know, it's just the mind seeking pleasure, attached to pleasure all the time, day and night. Yeah. And so, you know, just you can see what we're focused on. What do we think about all the time? My happiness. Now. Or if not this moment, ASAP. Okay? And we can begin to see how that mental state just is so constricting. And it causes misery right now. And it certainly causes us to create the karma that generates misery in the future as well. Okay? And it's all under the power of attachment. Okay? And how much we rebel at any slight discomfort. Yeah? Slight discomfort. Or the meal, it isn't exactly the way we want it. The temperature in the room isn't exactly the way we want it. The hardness or softness of the bed isn't the way we want it. You know, the color of our shirt isn't the way we want it. The sound, the tone of someone's voice isn't the way we want it. You know, all the time, just how can we get pleasure? It drives us crazy, doesn't it? Because nothing ever meets our satisfaction. I mean, think of it. How often have we ever been satisfied in our life? You know? And if you're satisfied, it lasts for about 30 seconds. And then, you know, on to something else. We need something else to stimulate us. Something else we can grab onto for attachment. Okay, so this phrase, for you embodied beings bound by the craving for existence, it's very powerful when you really begin to unpack it and think about what it means. Okay, so the purpose of explaining all of this, you know, is not so that we can feel guilty because we're attached to happiness, and is not so that we can feel guilty because we're attached to the pleasure of our body. Okay, Buddha didn't teach all this so that we could feel guilty. You know, we know how to feel guilty all by ourselves. Buddha didn't need to spend 45 years walking around India giving teachings in order for us to feel guilty. That's not the purpose of why he explained this. The purpose of why he explained this is so that we could wake up and see things for what they are, and because we want to be happy, develop the aspiration for real happiness. Okay, so instead of this low-grade happiness that constantly turns into dukkha and constantly betrays us, you know, the Buddha explained, look, this is low-grade happiness. You know, give it up, because it's not really happiness. And instead, aspire for the happiness of liberation, aspire for the bliss of enlightenment. Okay? And so the Buddha gave these teachings out of great compassion because he wanted us to be happy. You know, so like I said before, what we're renouncing is, you know, the misery that comes from being attached to something that doesn't really bring happiness, that we in our confusion think brings happiness. Okay? You getting what I'm saying? You're communicating here? Okay. So, somehow, you know, when you see the body for what it is, and, you know, seeing the autopsy is very useful in that respect, then it becomes a way to develop an antidote to apply against this rampant attachment to the pleasure of the body. Because it's just like, okay, it's just this hunk of meat. Yeah, I don't have to spend all my time and energy in life looking out, trying to eke out pleasure for it. You know, I have a body. It's the basis of my Dharma practice. We have a precious human life because we have this human body. And that's a very precious opportunity within cyclic existence. Having a human body, and especially a life in which we're able to meet the Dharma and practice the Dharma and meet teachings, you know, and teachers, that's very, very precious. So we take care of our body, because without this body, we're not going to be able to practice the Dharma in this life. So we take care of this body. We keep it clean. We keep it healthy. But we don't do it with the motivation of attachment. We do it with the motivation of using this body so that we can get out of cyclic existence. Okay? So we still take care of the body, but on a more practical level, without all this fussing. Okay? And then we begin to lessen all the attachment to how we look. And when we give up the attachment to how we look, the mind becomes so much more relaxed. Because especially nowadays, when we're fed so much from the media about looking good, you know, everybody's supposed to look young and attractive. I was in the doctor's office, when was it? It was just yesterday. Yesterday, day before. And they had the magazine, the AARP, you know, the one for retired citizens. The cover photo was some young, sexy-looking person. You know? It was like, come on!
And
they
would put gray hair for a woman.
Pardon?
They wouldn't put a woman on the cover with gray hair.
No. Not at all. Not at all. You know? And it's like, come on, can't we see other role models of how to grow old gracefully and how to feel good about yourself when you have gray hair and wrinkles and your body sags? You know? Why can't we still feel good about ourselves then? Why do we only like ourselves when we you know, are trying to look like the people in the magazines? And the people in the magazines don't even look like themselves because the things have all been computer altered. Yeah? So we're also neurotic trying to look young and beautiful, and nobody's getting younger, nobody's getting more beautiful. We're all getting older and uglier and close to death. You know? And why can't we age with grace? Really? You know, why can't we feel good about ourselves and think, okay, I'm older and uglier and close to death, and I feel like I have more to offer to other sentient beings today than I did yesterday. I have one iota more of wisdom, one iota more of compassion. My life is more meaningful today than it was yesterday. Why? Because I've practiced the Dharma. Why don't we see examples of that in the media? No? Just let me talk to the media. Give a little piece of my mind. You know, but think about it, really, and how blind we are, how much we buy into this image that is presented to us on the newspapers, the radio, the TV, the movies, everything. How much we buy into it. You know, even when we think we don't, you know, because we're not people who conform to the majority, you know, we're the kind of progressive side in America, you know, we're not Republicans. Sorry if there's some Republicans in the audience. You know, but we think, oh, you know, I'm not like those people, you know, whoever those people is, you know. I'm not like the people who has faceless. I only dye my hair. I only, you know, go to the gym with the motivation not to keep my body healthy but to look good so I can attract somebody, you know? I mean, we think we're not buying into it, and yet we buy into it. Yeah, it's so sad. It's so sad. Yeah. So this is why the Buddha taught about it, because you can see how much incredible mental suffering we have trying to look like the people in the magazines. and how much self-loathing we develop by not liking who we are, because our body is doesn't look like the people in the magazines. You know, that is not healthy. That is not healthy. You know, and especially how kids, even at young ages, are being taught all this self-concern and self-occupation with the body. It's very, very sad. Okay? So the Buddha taught us so we could realize, hey, you know, this body is just a vehicle for practicing the Dharma. It's beautiful, it's ugly, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. Okay? Use it wisely for the benefit of sentient beings and be happy. That's why the Buddha taught all this. You know, free our mind from all this craving, the binds, shackles of the craving. Okay? For you embodied beings bound by the craving for existence, without the pure determination to be free, which is another translation for renunciation, okay, from the ocean of existence, there is no way for you to pacify the attractions to its pleasurable effects. Okay, so without developing this attitude of renunciation that sees through the glitter of cyclic existence, there's no way to liberate our mind from this intoxication with pleasure, you know, with low-grade pleasure. Okay. Therefore, Lama Tsongkhapa recommends, thus, from the outset, seek to generate the determination to be free. Okay, first thing. How do we do this? By contemplating the freedoms and fortunes, okay, of our precious human life, which is so difficult to find, and the fleeting nature of our life. So thinking of the advantages of our precious human life and the fact that we're not going to live forever, the fleeting nature of our life, that we're aging, moment by moment by moment, going towards death, and that we don't know when death is going to come. And yet death is the one definite thing that we have to do. Okay? So, by contemplating those things, reverse the clinging to this life. So all that attachment to this life, all that obsession of do people like me, do they respect me, do I fit in, how's my marriage going, how do I look in these people's eyes, do I have enough money, am I successful, am I beautiful, am I handsome, am I a good enough athlete, you know, am I rich enough. All this incredible self-doubt, you know, that we suffer so much from, and self-loathing when we think, you know, we aren't the best. How to free our minds from it? Meditate on the freedoms and fortunes of this life and the fact that we're going to die and it's all going to go away and there's nothing to be attached to. Okay, so the purpose of this life is to get ourselves out of samsara and to work for the benefit of sentient beings and give up all this worry and anxiety that we have. Yeah? Because what lies behind all the worry and anxiety? It's attachment, isn't it? Yeah? And we each have to do our own research in our own mind, what exactly we're attached to that is making us so anxious. You know, is it fitting in? Is it our looks? Is it being seen as successful? Is it, you know, long life? Is it health? Is it appearances, physical appearances? Is it wealth? Is it, you know, being listened to? Who knows what it is? But if we search behind our anxiety, there's generally attachment. You know, looking for some kind of security in samsara. And samsara by nature is insecure. There is no security in samsara. Okay? That's why we want to renounce samsara. There is no security. Why try and be secure in a place where there's no security. Better to get out. Yeah? Okay? So this is why we develop the determination to be free. And I think the more we develop it, the actually happier we become in this life. Because the more we let go of the attachment to the happiness to this life, because we realize that there's nothing to be attached to, then the more happiness we have, because we're not all stressed out by this, all this anxiety. Okay? Because if you're not attached to the happiness of this life, it doesn't matter if you're getting old and fat and ugly, or old and thin and ugly and wrinkles. You know, who cares? It doesn't matter. You know, people like you or don't like you. It doesn't matter. People criticize you or praise you. It doesn't matter. You have a good reputation or a bad one. It doesn't matter. People think you're successful. People think you're garbage. It doesn't matter. People treat you right, they treat you wrong, they respect you, they don't respect you, they're prejudiced against you, they blame you for things you didn't do, they blame you for things you did do. It doesn't matter. You know, when we're free from the attachment to all this life, to this life, all this anxiety and stress just goes away. Because who cares? You know, because on the day that we die, do we want to be stressing out about all this stuff? You know, oh, my blouse doesn't match my pants. Or they saw me wear this tie last time. You know, is that what you want to be thinking about when you're dying? My boss criticized me. Is that what you want to be thinking about when you're dying? You know, and so the more we're able to give up the attachment to this life, wow, you know, the more peace and joy there is in the mind right now. Okay? Is it making some sense to you? Yeah? Okay. So that's how far we got today. And we will continue tomorrow.